This podcast of Word of Mouth is sponsored by
Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money
through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans.
Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock.
Creating a new model for healthcare.
Where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Doucet Survey.
Serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England.
Now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at DOUCETsurvey.com. That's DoucetSurvey.com.
Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Imagine spending 23 hours a day in a small, windowless cell with virtually no human contact, no external stimuli, and no sunlight. That's the reality for more than 80,000 U.S. prisoners currently being held in solitary confinement. While most other democratic nations have discontinued the practice, long-term solitary confinement is increasingly routine in American prisons. A series of studies shows that the psychological effects of such deprivation counters any goals of rehabilitation. Joseph Stromberg is a science reporter at Vox, and we spoke to him last year when he wrote about the science of solitary confinement for SmithsonianMag.com. Now, that number sounds very high. Between 80 and 81,000 male and female inmates in solitary at any given time. Is that number on the rise?
You're right in saying that it's a huge amount, and it is on the rise. I think for researchers, one of the frustrating things is that there's no central piece of data that the U.S. government collects on solitary, because sometimes it's federal prisoners, sometimes it's state-level prisoners. But the best censuses do indicate that it's somewhere around 80 or 81,000. And it's a number that is increasing because prison administrators use solitary confinement for a few different reasons nowadays.
Well, why? Why would people end up in solitary?
The basic context is that our prison population is overall rising. But administrators use it for a few different reasons, use solitary for a few different reasons, I should say. There's the most basic one of disciplining prisoners, which is probably what most of us think of when we think about solitary. It's also used as a tool coercing prisoners into cooperating with different rules. Maybe cooperating with an ongoing police investigation or preventing them from talking to others during an investigation. It's even sometimes used at prisoners' own request if they feel there's a threat within the prison population to their safety as a preventative measure. And so based on the fact that the prison population itself is increasing and all these different uses for it, it's exploded over the past couple decades in the U.S.
So paint a picture for us of what solitary confinement is like, you know, the size of the cell, sun exposure, human exposure.
Yeah, it's probably hard for a lot of listeners to imagine living this way. The average cell is maybe 80 square feet on average, so that's like the size of a queen-size bed. You won't have any exposure to sunlight. You might not have a window, so it's not the bars that most of us picture when we think of a prison cell, but rather just a steel door. And you're going to be in there at least 23 hours a day. You might have an exercise period either out in a prison yard or in an enclosed inside area. You won't have human contact. You won't have stimuli. A lot of solitary prisoners, even when they do receive visits from friends or family, they are prevented from touching them. And so I think one of the most really disturbing things to think about is that they might go years, if they're in solitary for years, they might go years without touching another person except for when guards are putting them in restraints.
So given that you're not touching anyone, you have no contact with others, what are some of the psychological effects of being in solitary confinement?
Yeah, the psychological effects are difficult to study because many prisons are resistant to letting researchers or academics inside. But Craig Haney, a psychologist at UC Santa Cruz, who have been able to gain access and conduct interviews with some prisoners, he's conducted interviews with 500 prisoners in solitary from four different states, and he's found that these prisoners have significantly higher rates of symptoms like dizziness, heart palpitations, chronic depression, hallucinations, suicidal thoughts, than the general prison population. And a study that actually came out last week found that isolated inmates in the New York State prison system are 7 times more likely to hurt or kill themselves than the general inmate population.
So one of the things that really struck me is you cited some evidence that there are neurological implications of long-term isolation. What might those be?
Yeah. So like the psychology, the neuroscientific implications are even more difficult to study because there are no prisons that are allowing researchers to come in with MRI imagers or other types of technology and look at the brains of prisoners. So they really have to look at other types of models and their basic understandings about the principles of the brain. But those have, for one, there's the fact that so much of our brain activity is driven by circadian rhythms. So that's our body's natural clock that's set by the rising and the falling of the sun every day.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's easy to imagine that if you never saw the sun, your circadian rhythms would be interfered with. Other research has found that when people who have chronic depression for extended periods of time, the activity in their brains is less well aligned with their circadian rhythms. And there's been other work that shows people who are restricted access to the sun are more prone to depression. And so it's easy to imagine that if you don't see the sun any day for years in a row, you're much more likely to develop depression. And there's also other work that shows the hippocampus, which is an important brain structure involved in things like memory, cognition, decision-making. This can dramatically shrink over time in people who are depressed for extended periods. And so this might account for some of the evidence we have that people who spend long periods of time in isolation are perform worse on decision-making skills, their memory is not as sharp, and they, in general, appear to be less well-equipped to reenter U.S. society.
Joseph Stromberg is a science reporter at Fox. He wrote about what happens to inmates held in solitary confinement, both psychologically and physiologically, for SmithsonianMag.com. Joseph, you just got to something I was going to ask you about. Inmates can become increasingly violent. Their decision-making faculties are changed.
Mm-hmm.
What do those things mean in terms of rehabilitation, the goal of imprisoning them in the first place?
Yeah, I think the implications of this are disturbing. I think one interesting thing I'd like to mention is that this isn't all exactly news. The beginning of institutional solitary confinement was in the mid-1800s in the U.S. as part of something called the Pennsylvania model of imprisonment, and this was reformers who thought that to rehabilitate prisoners, they had to isolate them and allow them to get in touch with their own thoughts and connect with God. And even back then, administrators, prison governors realized that this was essentially driving many inmates insane and doing the opposite. And so that's exactly what we're seeing today as well. All evidence is that prisoners who have spent extended periods of time in solitary confinement are less well-equipped to enter society at large. And if that's one of the goals that we have for the prison system, solitary's failing at it.
And we hear a little bit of this firsthand from Robert King. He was on a panel at the American Association for the Advancement of Science's annual meeting in Chicago. He was confined in solitary in a Louisiana prison until his murder conviction was overturned in 2001. What did he talk about for the experience?
Robert King is now an activist and an author who's fighting against the culture of solitary confinement in the U.S. prison system. And he spoke about how he thinks he fared a lot better than many people who stayed in solitary. You know, he was always hopeful that his conviction would be rightly overturned. But at the same time, he spoke about really disturbing physical changes. His eyesight began failing him when he spent time in solitary, and he realized that he'd have to perform different types of eye exercises just because he was never asked to focus on anything further than about 6 feet away.
And how long was he confined?
He was confined for 29 years.
29 years?
Yeah, from 1972 through 2001. And yes, and like we said, the murder conviction was overturned. And so apart from his failing eyesight, he spoke about how since he's been reintroduced to the world at large, he has difficulty navigating large spaces. Navigation is actually a capacity that's tied to the hippocampus, that brain structure we spoke about that can shrink when people are depressed for long periods of time. And so he says he's no longer able to, you know, navigate a walk of 10 city blocks. That part of his brain simply wasn't called upon to navigate the world at large for such a long time that it's made that difficult for him.
So he's one activist, Robert King. Mm-hmm. I know there's a lot of, you know, attempted legislation and activism in the criminal justice system in general, but I'm mm-hmm. wondering if there is a legal case that can be made based on the Eighth Amendment prohibiting cruel and unusual punishment against solitary confinement.
Yeah, I think that's a possibility that a lot of researchers are looking into now, researchers and activists both. I think as the evidence builds about how solitary affects the brain and affects people's psychology, I think that might be an avenue that is pursued in the future.
Well, last Wednesday, New York State government reached a settlement banning the mm-hmm. use of extreme isolation mm-hmm. for juveniles and limiting it somewhat for adults. So do you think, Joseph, the tide may be turning?
I think that's hard to say. I think that it's important for us to at least begin analyzing how solitary affects people, because I think one of the remarkable things is that prison systems have been doing this without really looking at scientifically at the consequences of it for a very long time. And I think as researchers and psychologists and neuroscientists gather more information about it, it might prompt the tide to start turning. I think the New York State decision is a big one. I think that's one of the larger state prison systems, and up until now had one of the largest amounts of prisoners in solitary confinement. Mm. So it's a start.
Joseph Strongberg, thanks for your time.
Thank you so much.
Joseph Strongberg is a science reporter at Fox. He wrote about what happens to inmates held in solitary confinement, both psychologically and physiologically, for SmithsonianMag.com.
Well, it's happened to everybody at one point or another. You open up your Facebook feed and see an outrageous photo someone posted, maybe of John Lennon playing guitar alongside Che Guevara, or maybe a photo of the Buddha carved in an impossible-to-get-to rock formation, and you think, that cannot be real. But it looks so real. As photo editing software becomes more sophisticated, telling real from fake photos on the internet is becoming more of a challenge. Matt Novak writes the Paleo Future blog over at Gizmodo.com, which is where we found his post, Inside the Fakes Factory, by chat with a viral image creator. Well, let's start with this Buddha carved in the rock formation. People may have seen this photograph. It is just spectacular. It looks like something out of a movie set. Who is the artist behind it?
Well, it's actually an anonymous artist. I was put in contact with a man who wanted to remain anonymous, who's part of an online art collective known as Reality Cues. And they have a project called Graffiti Lab, where they manipulate different images that they find online. And it turns out a lot of these images wind up being passed along as real.
So does he go like full Banksy manipulated voice, or did he speak with you straight on?
We actually just chatted over GChat, so that was how I talked to that person. But I've talked to a number of other people through various means who want to keep themselves away from the public eye for one reason or another.
Now, we joke about the idea of pressing a viral button to make something on the internet spread exponentially. But this guy and others who work in this Graffiti Lab project has kind of cracked the code for making images go viral. What's the method?
Well, you know, obviously this person from Reality Cues uses Photoshop, and it was actually an interesting point in our discussion when I asked him, you know, sort of how, if there were other images other than this incredibly popular one of the Buddha carved into this tall rock formation in China, just impossibly tall. It would have been incredibly hard to make, and it obviously was not made. It was a Photoshop creation. But I asked him, you know, are there other images that are obviously fake that get passed around? And he, you know, clearly was amused by this, because it's so hard sometimes to see what is obviously fake. One thing that might be obviously fake to one person could be completely plausible to another. You know, it's interesting to see how people want so desperately for something to be incredible in the world, and for that to be some sort of validation that people can really do incredible things.
Well, it's not only that people want them to be real. Some people say they visited these sites.
That's true. He sent me along a Tumblr post that a young woman had made where She claimed that she had actually seen this Buddha carved up in this impossibly tall rock formation.
Well, maybe in a, you know, a Shaolin warrior movie or something like
that. Sure, sure.
But you describe these photographs as clearly photoshopped. But a lot of people do believe these manipulated photos are real. Why do you think that is? I mean, to you, they look absolutely fake. To others, they see a place and think, oh, there are so many places in the world I haven't been. This could be real.
It's interesting because not everything that I look at in this sort of what's become a recurring series for me, looking at different fake images online, not everything is obviously fake. Sometimes something just doesn't smell right. And I'll use some of the fabulous tools that are now available online to what's called reverse image search them, which is to put, rather than, you know, most people are familiar with Google, where you type in some kind of search query that's via text. There are actually tools now where you can plug in an image and look at other places where that image has appeared. And oftentimes you'll find the original source for it. Other times it takes other methods, but that's obviously a good first place to look. Sometimes it's the description itself that's off. It's not necessarily that someone had manipulated an image. For instance, today I just had a post that went up that showed Audrey Hepburn supposedly dancing, and it turns out it was a very recent stock image of a dancer, but from it looked so much like her that I had to find a different image of it, a higher res image of it, in order to be able to zoom in and show that it clearly wasn't her.
Hmm. Are they playing with that idea that our image of reality is so often photoshopped? Or all of these fake images kind of creating skepticism in a public that will never believe what they see?
Well, I think it's a bit of both. I think that, you know, a lot of people see this as sort of a new phenomenon that started with Photoshop, and that it's turning us all into terrible skeptics. And I'm not sure that that's entirely true. You know, we have to remember that long before the invention of Photoshop, people were making fake images. For instance, there was an image of Teddy Roosevelt riding a moose made in 1912, and it's a pre-Photoshop manipulated image that still gets passed around today, funnily enough. So it's tough because a lot of these issues are not new. I can't speak to what the actual motivations of this online art collective are, but they definitely want to highlight some of these issues about how we define what is real when it comes to landscape or architecture.
Well, I'm interested in how you feel about it as the editor of Paleo Future. I mean, you look through all sorts of old imagery and writing about how people predicted the future. So in a way, there becomes this kind of aspirational quality, you know, to a photograph of us or a picture of us, an image of people on a moving sidewalk or in a jetpack or something.
Right.
So can it provide some kind of dreamy sense of where we're going?
For sure. I think you really hit it on the head there with aspirational being the key word. You know, as you said, I study all of these past visions of the future, whether it's jetpacks or flying cars or meal pills. And I often come across these sorts of ideas. That's actually what got me interested in this fake viral images to begin with. It was this image that was getting passed around of people supposedly on an airplane in the 1960s. And the caption that was getting passed around is that this is what coach class used to look like. And it was incredibly luxurious. It was, you know, people had plenty of leg room, and it was lots of headroom, and it would just look very civilized, for lack of a better word. The catch was that it was actually a mock-up that Boeing had done. It wasn't a real plane. It was an aspirational image for Boeing. It was a plane that had never actually existed in the real world outside of a photo studio. This was the first sort of kicking off for me this interest in these broader ideas about sort of what we want to believe about the future and what we want to believe about history. I think we often romanticize the past, especially when it comes to air travel, while forgetting any number of different issues or even forgetting that, you know, some of these images could be fake.
Well, we can dream, Matt.
We can, yes.
Matt Novak writes the Paleo Future blog over at gizmodo.com, which is where we found his post, Inside the Fakes Factory, my chat with a viral image creator. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Virginia.
There is money to be made in playing on people's faith and curiosity. Witness this slice of history from the Memory Palace podcast. Nate DeMayo looked into what may be the greatest hoax in American history. A pair of men who capitalized on the belief that giants once roamed the earth.
Henry Nichols wakes up early one Saturday and rides out to Stubb Newell's farm. Stubb is his brother-in-law, and sometimes he throws him some cash to do some odd jobs, like paint a fence or whatever. This time it's to dig a well. Henry brings his buddy Gideon with him. Gideon had lost his arm a few years back in the Civil War, but he says he'd be willing to give Henry a hand, so to speak. And Stubb takes them out to the field behind his barn, points to some spot in the ground. It seems totally arbitrary. And Henry and Gideon start digging. And the whole thing is taking forever. The ground is really hard, and they're digging for hours. Then Henry's shovel hits something. Gideon clambers down into the hole. He starts clearing away the dirt with his one hand. And he finds a foot. A giant foot. George Hull was getting nowhere. He had spent years farming tobacco in upstate New York, trying to find riches in the soil. He had done pretty well during the war. People wanted their cigars and they couldn't get them from the Carolinas anymore. Then the South surrendered and everything went south, up north. His business fell apart. So George Hull decided to look for actual riches in the dirt. He headed to the gold fields of California. And on his way west, Hull stops in Ackley, Iowa. And he's at a bar and he gets into an argument with a Methodist preacher. George Hull is an atheist, and a loud one. And the preacher is a drinker, and a loud one, and the two go at it about the Bible all night long. The preacher is all literal word of God on one side, and Hull's all book of fairy stories on the other. And the crux of their particular version of this predictable argument hinges upon a line in Genesis that says, "There were giants upon the earth in those days." And that is just too much for George Hull. He can't stand how dumb people are. They'll just believe anything. Henry and Gideon believed they had found a dead Indian. That's what they said when Stubb Newell came back to check on how well the well was doing. "I declare," one of them said, "some old Indian has been buried here." And it was some old Indian. The body that lay there in the dirt was 10 feet tall. It was hard as a rock, heavy as hell. A nude male figure lying prone, twisted slightly at the hips, sort of smiling. Henry and Gideon started freaking out. For years, they had heard the people of the Onondaga tribe tell stories of stone giants that lived in the forest. Maybe this was one of them. And maybe it would wake up. But Stubb Newell had a different theory. One that had been handed to him by George Hull. One night, 2 years earlier, Hull had ridden into Cardiff, New York, looking for someone who had a farm, a shovel, and a good poker face. Because he had a giant he was looking to unload. He found his man in Stubb Newell. Hull had told him about the preacher in Iowa, and how annoyed he had made him, and how he wanted to stick it to that guy, and stick it to everyone, really, who believed in nonsense and hokum. So he came up with a plan for a grand hoax. He would make a petrified man. It can take millions of years to petrify something. It took George Hull, too. He spent a few months getting money together by selling off shares of the inevitable windfall that a petrified man would bring. It took a while longer to find a giant block of marble and a sculptor to carve it into a giant, and then time to make this freshly carved statue look like ancient flesh, sanding it down and chipping out chunks of ankle and shoulder and thigh and dipping it in acid until it looked the way he imagined a giant man would have if he had fallen into a bog back in the time before Abraham, and then had become petrified. And then he dug a hole in the dead of night. A year later, Stubb Newell was standing by a hole in the ground, with a lump in his throat. A day after orchestrating the incredible discovery of a biblical giant in his backyard, he was already making money off of it. He'd put a rope around the pit, and charged his neighbors $1 for a closer look. But the big payoff, the riches he'd been fantasizing about since George Hull knocked on his door the spring before, depended on the four men in the hole. People needed to believe it. It was one thing for some farmers and field hands to aw shuck some word of mouth around his little hamlet. His neighbors would believe anything. For the giant to really draw a crowd, He needed people with some actual authority to buy in. He needed scientists. And here were four doctors from neighboring towns, trained physicians, crawling through the dirt, poking and measuring, and conferring in authoritative tones. And when the four men climbed up from the hole, muddy and wide-eyed, and declared that the giant was the genuine article, Stubb Newell breathed easier, and he put up a tent. The world descended upon Cardiff, New York. Headlines called the statue the Cardiff Giant and called it the biggest scientific discovery of the century. Tourists rode in on horseback and omnibus. Within weeks, whole hotels were built to house the gawking throng. Stubb Newell was making money giant hand over giant fist and squirreling it away for George Hall and his secret cabal of investors. And then they took the giant on the road, and at every stop, the crowds grew. But so did the risk. Each town had its own experts, its professors, its lecturers of note, who'd all take a crack at the giant. But most bought it. The giant, Genesis, the whole thing. Some didn't, and they said it was a statue, but an ancient statue from some lost civilization, which would have been a giant discovery, if not a petrified one. But every now and then, someone would call it what it was, just a giant scam. But George Hall and his investors managed to stay a step ahead, moving on to another city before people caught on and demanded answers, and they would have to own up to reality. There was one person who didn't care at all whether it was real. P.T. Barnum knew a good show when he saw one, and he made them an offer. He would pay them $60,000 to rent the giant for 3 months. And this was a good deal. That's about $1 million of today's dollars. And George Hall had only spent the equivalent of $30,000 to make his petrified marvel. Their tour was still doing well, but not that well. They'd never make that kind of money in 3 months. They didn't have Barnum's promotional genius, and most importantly, they didn't have his mammoth museum in downtown Manhattan. But they didn't take the offer. Because Manhattan was the problem. They had managed to make a small fortune off an outrageous fake. But people were starting to poke holes in the story, letting little drops of doubt seep in. 3 months in the spotlight, in the biggest city in the world, the whole thing was bound to get washed away. So they said no. And Barnum said fine. And then he made his own giant. No one could figure out exactly how he did it. Maybe someone made a plaster cast in the dead of night. Maybe someone had been surreptitiously making elaborate sketches at every stop on the tour. But in the fall of 1869, an exact replica of the Cardiff Giant went on display in Barnum's museum. And of course, he claimed it was the real thing. The owners of the real fake giant were outraged. They threatened to sue. And Barnum said, bring it on. You bring your giant into court, and I'll bring mine, and we'll ask a judge to decide which one is really a petrified person. George Hall knew he was beat. He signed a book deal. And then he admitted the whole thing. And people still came to see the giant for a while. It may not have been a real magical, mythical creature, but it was still pretty cool. It wasn't a real giant, but it was a giant celebrity. And George Hall took his money, and he sold some books. In reading the book, George Hall seems like kind of a dick. And this from a person who loves a good hoax. I can totally get behind a charismatic con man. But George Hall began this whole thing with the premise that people are idiots. And looking back on it, he seems pretty smug. Like he was sure that he pulled the rug out from under the faithful fools who bought into this biblical stuff and this magic and mystical nonsense. But the truth is, he didn't have a rug. He had a tablecloth. You yank it out and the silverware is still in place. You haven't spilled a drop. If belief could survive Copernicus and Galileo, it could survive the Cardiff Giant. And you didn't have to be a fool to be fooled in 1869. You were a farmer. You were a dock worker or a candlestick maker or a scrivener. Where had you ever been? What had you ever seen? How good were your textbooks? How learned were your learned men? And this fake giant had real power. One day you're tilling your field or you're working your terrible job, living your hard life. Someone over yonder digs up a giant in their backyard. It had enough power to change people's days. to draw a crowd and to make some people rich. It gave a one-handed farmhand a story to dine out on for the rest of his life back in the 1870s. It gave him a Wikipedia entry today. It sounds enough like magic to me. I'd pay a dollar to see that.
And our thanks to the Memory Palace podcast for that story.
Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. In 1998, the novelist Walter Kern was between novels, living in Montana, and working as an editor for Time when he was asked to accompany a crippled dog to New York City to be adopted. It was then that Kern first spoke to a not particularly pleasant but intriguing man who called himself Clark Rockefeller. Yes, that Rockefeller. Or so Kern thought. It was only after he was arrested for kidnapping nearly 10 years later that Clark Rockefeller was exposed as Christian Karl Gerhard Schrider, not only an imposter, but now a convicted murderer. Kern's book, Blood Will Out, is his account of being taken in by the eccentric and seductive sham. It's part memoir, part true crime, and part exposé of how notions of class and status can inform our perceptions. I spoke with Kern when the book was first released. It's now available in paperback. Well, tell us about that first conversation that drew you to New York to meet this man named Clark. What was your impression of him?
Well, he sounded like he had had a very insulated upbringing among, you know, prep schools and nannies and that kind of thing. I asked him what he did for a living, and his answer was, I'm a freelance central banker. He said he ran the economies of third world countries from his home computer using special software and equations. And he also told me he'd never, for example, drunk a Coca-Cola or eaten in a restaurant. And he went on like this. And you might think it was preposterous, but to me, a novelist, it was first of all intriguing. And secondly, I'd met these privileged types. I went to Princeton and I'd studied at Oxford. And in my experience, they were all a little kooky. And he was no kookier than some of them. He was also pretty amusing to talk to, like no one I'd ever met. And so I made it a goal to meet him.
You're a really smart, really successful guy. Your novels, Thumbsucker and Up in the Air, have been made into films, the latter Oscar-nominated film starring George Clooney. You know, you've by this time, you've known him for 15 years. You were friends with him pretty much for 10 years. You're a journalist, and you never looked up his identity?
Well, I mean, his name was Clark Rockefeller, he said, and in about 2004, when it became more common to Google people, I put it into the computer, and I got many Rockefellers that were associated with the name Clark. There was a Mary Clark Rockefeller, who I believe was married to Nelson. John D. Rockefeller's first company was called Clark and Rockefeller.
Mm-hmm.
But in a strange way, I didn't expect that I would find him, because he told me he was a very private person who kind of kept his identity off the internet. So when I saw this smoke but didn't ever see any fire in terms of direct references to him, I thought, well, he must be pretty powerful to keep himself off of these search engines. Mm-hmm. So in a weird way, it confirmed for me his position and power.
But we get this portrait of yourself and other people gratifying yourself or themselves by following the crumbs left out by Gerhard Schrider. I'm looking for an example that you can give to us of how you were taken in, or maybe some of the gaps you might have noticed then and figured out now that you know who he is. Oh, okay, that all makes sense to me.
Well, the first time I met him in New York, he took me over to his apartment to show me his art collection. And there were huge canvases on the walls and standing against the walls, Pollocks, Rothkos, de Koonings, Motherwells. And at some point he said, do you know how Mark Rothko died? And I said, I think he killed himself. And he said, right. Yes, he slashed his wrists in his studio. And he turned around one of these Rothkos that was leaning against the wall, and he said, do you see these little specks back here? This is actually the last painting he was working on when he died, and this is his blood. And all of that created this sort of huge, you know, and strange narrative that I was still processing by the time he moved on to another, you know, incredible story. He had the power to capture your mind and sort of stop your rational processes. And you know, as a storyteller myself, at some level, I really enjoyed it, and I think I may even have sort of admired his mastery, though I didn't think of these necessarily as stories. I thought of them as true anecdotes, which were maybe being embellished.
Hmm. You were taken in.
Everybody fell for it.
Well, tell me
not
more.
There's no evidence of anybody not falling for it who knew him. You know, I went to his trial when he was found out, and person after person got up there and said, I always suspected there was something about him, mm-hmm. you know, that wasn't right. But they'd married him. They'd hired him. They'd gone to social events with him. If people were sitting around thinking he was a fraud, nobody ever acted on the suspicion.
Mm. Well, he did marry a woman who worked for McKinsey, I believe, Sandra Boss.
Yes.
She let him manage her family's money, and she made a lot of money. Now, he did have a house in Cornish. He did have a New York apartment, which I can imagine he could use as a backdrop for being Clark Rockefeller. But how did he get to that point? Can you help complete the ruse for us?
Well, he was very smart. One thing he knew how to manipulate was the system of private clubs on the East Coast. He went to a yacht club in Greenwich, Connecticut, and you know, he talked his way into it, and he held himself out to be important. And once that club admitted him, he had reciprocity at other clubs, and he'd sort of move on up the chain. He was always positioning himself and using props like the paintings and associations with his colleagues. And, you know, I'm sure he used his wife's position at McKinsey to get into parties that, you know, high-level business people and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, our job as human beings is not to be constantly running checks on each other. You know, in the last few years, we've seen this capacity to Google each other sort of expand out of control. But that was just not how it was done before. You asked if someone knew so-and-so, or you took it on faith when they were introduced by a friend of yours. To think that somebody is a complete fraud and that all their possessions are counterfeit and, you know, that their past is made up and that they, in fact, as he wasn't, aren't even an American, is a big leap.
Walter Kern, how did you figure it out? How was his secret exposed for you?
I never figured it out. His secret was exposed for me the same way it was for the entire country and everybody else who knew him. He kidnapped his daughter in Boston after a custody proceeding. There was an Amber Alert. He was caught days later. The Rockefeller family said, we don't know who this guy is. It came out that he was a German immigrant who'd come over here at 17 years old. Then, not long after that, it turned out he was a suspect in a murder all the way back to 1985, and a grisly murder, one in which the victim was cut up into pieces. And so can you think of a bigger disparity between terrible killer and supposed Rockefeller? I don't think there is one.
Mm. Well, you went to witness the trial for the murder of John Sohus, if I'm saying mm-hmm. that properly. How did he behave to you there? I mean, you locked eyes at some point. Was he still pretending to be Clark Rockefeller or somebody else?
In the part of the trial that was in front of the jury, he did pretend to be Clark Rockefeller. He asked the judge, in fact, to call him Clark Rockefeller. His lawyers asked the judge, and the judge refused. But he dressed as he had as Clark, in a blue blazer, sockless loafers, wire-rimmed spectacles, and he acted very gentlemanly. Of course, on days when the jury wasn't there, he was brought in shackles and an orange prison jumpsuit. But, you know, when there was an audience judging him, he played the gentleman to a T.
Through this process of finding out from this manhunt who he really was, and admitting and realizing that you've been duped, I'm interested about the process that you went through of thinking, oh my God, it's all coming together.
Well, you see, this book is like the story of a magic trick. First, I show you what it was like to watch the magic trick, what it was like to be in his company and be fooled by him. And then I show you through the prism of attending his murder trial and finding out what his MO was and learning more and more about him, what I think really happened. Why, for example, did he show me a Rothko with blood on the back? Mm. Well, I think it was because he was obsessed with blood. He'd cut up a body. He'd probably lived with that body for a period of weeks in this little guest house while he was digging its grave. A way to cope with his, you know, nightmarish experience of bloody murder was to put blood on art and sort of upscale the whole experience.
Mm-hmm.
He played games of Clue dressed up in his you know, finery as Professor Plum. And that was also an upscaling of, I think, the horrible murder experience. Mm-hmm. So the book is really double vision story.
Well, in painting the portrait of why you were duped, you actually go even further later in the book and suggest that you are somehow complicit in his masquerade. What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, this may offend some, but I'm going to speak on a much larger scale. Clark, who I have evidence and reason to believe, is kind of maybe has some feelings for the Nazi past of Germany, maybe even some positive feelings. You know, came from a country that allowed one of the greatest crimes of all time to take place within its borders. And though everyone afterwards claimed that they hadn't seen it coming and didn't know what was going on, digging down tells you that even ignorance is in some ways a form of collaboration. Mm-hmm. I was very hard on myself looking back on the relationship because it wasn't just that I trusted him or was gullible or was blind. I also at certain levels wanted things from him, and I wanted those things badly enough not to pay attention to his inconsistencies and his tall tales. Very concretely, I used to think, oh, he'll give me a stock tip someday, sort of some Rockefeller inside information that maybe I can use to help me and make a wise investment. Things like that. They say you can't cheat an honest man. And I was cheated. Therefore, I must not have been completely honest. I certainly wasn't honest with myself.
What about trusting people that you meet now? Are you, you know, sort of on tenderhooks and really wonder?
Well, I'll tell you honestly. I've gone on Twitter in the last week, and there are certain people who show up on Twitter who have profile photos that are, you know, pictures of movie stars, not themselves, and don't have any followers that I'm convinced are him. You know, in jail with a smuggled cell phone trying to make fun of me. It's the kind of thing he'd do. Ever since this experience, I've seen that there is much more masquerading and imposture out there in society than we realize. And once you know that, it does put a stutter in your step. It makes you a little paranoid, and I've healed from most of that. But, you know, in this age of Facebook and social media, when people are not always what they say they are or even who they say they are, we maybe are right to be a little paranoid. Mm-hmm. Not being completely trusting and vulnerable beings is probably a wise thing at this stage in history.
Walter Curran, I want to thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
And that was Walter Curran, author of Blood Will Out, The True Story of a Murder, a Mystery, and a Masquerade. The book is now available in paperback. Thanks so much for your listening time today. There is so much more to hear and to explore at wordofmouthradio.org. That's where your subscription to the Word of Mouth podcast awaits you. You can also sign up for it by searching Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes. And if you like the podcast, write a review, pass it on, tell a friend. After all, the best suggestions travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. We'll be back with more Word of Mouth tomorrow, too, right here on New Hampshire Public Radio.